Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy, by Jeffrey Toobin. The cover of the book is white, with a picture of a presidential pen across the middle. A review appears at the top of the book cover by David Gran, the number one best-selling author of The Wager. It says, "A splendid narrative about political power and mercy." The reviewer is Jennifer Zalai. What a President's Pardon Says About His Soul. A new book by the legal journalist Jeffrey Toobin plumbs the dubious history of the presidential pardon. There is a color picture of President Gerald Ford in front of a window with microphones on his desk. He is looking directly at the camera, announcing the pardon of Nixon. The caption reads, "President Gerald Ford grants former President Richard Nixon a full, free, and absolute pardon on September 8, 1974. When it comes to pardons, presidents are kings, the legal journalist Jeffrey Toobin writes in his new book, The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy. It's not for nothing that President Trump, who has long been dazzled by royal pomp, was keen to brag about his pardon powers during his first term. "I have the absolute right to pardon myself," he tweeted in 2018, "but why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong?" In some ways, Toobin's book is impeccably timed. In December, President Joe Biden pardoned his son Hunter, despite previous pledges not to. In his final minutes in office, Biden went on to pardon five other members of his family. Trump, upon taking office later that day, pardoned or commuted the sentences of the more than 1,500 of his supporters who rioted at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Toobin completed this book before Trump started his second term, but in an epilogue, he presciently predicted that Trump would issue a blanket pardon to all of the January 6 defendants. When he pardons them, Trump will, in effect, pardon himself. But the pardon isn't primarily about Trump or Biden. Toobin explains that presidential powers of clemency have their roots in the royal prerogative of mercy, a strangely monarchical vestige for a democracy that had rebelled against the king. Still, early proponents of the pardon power insisted that it ultimately benefited the people. Alexander Hamilton called the pardon the benign prerogative that would soften the harsh penalties of criminal law. Without an easy access to exceptions in favor of unfortunate guilt, Hamilton explained, justice would wear a countenance too sanguinary and cruel. From such lofty beginnings has flowed plenty of trouble. The fact that there is no check or balance on the power of the pardon has invited chaos in the executive branch, Toobin writes. As much as presidents like to cast pardons as unequivocal gestures of mercy, he maintains that they are better understood as political acts. Abraham Lincoln offered amnesty to ordinary Southerners in exchange for oaths of loyalty to the Union because he wanted to hold the country together. Andrew Jackson granted pardons to the leaders of the Confederacy without seeming to care about the potential for such impunity to tear the country apart. Pardons are manifestations of the presidential id, Toobin writes. The unilateral nature of the power means that a pardon reveals a president's truest self. Most of his book is given over to recounting what was, at least until recently, the most controversial presidential pardon in American history, Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon. On August 9, 1974, Nixon resigned from the presidency after the House Judiciary Committee recommended that he be impeached for obstruction of justice in the Watergate scandal. Merely a month later, President Ford, who had assumed office after serving as Nixon's vice president, announced that he was granting a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon because the former president and his loved ones have suffered enough. Tubin offers a granular narrative of all the secretive machinations that led to that day. Nixon knew that he couldn't be the one to float the idea of a pardon to Ford. Such an agreement would have been unseemly, making it look as if Ford was getting the presidency in exchange for a pardon. But as Tubin makes clear, there was also the matter of Ford's avoidant personality. Nixon was the consummate schemer. Ford was both blessed and cursed by his placid temperament and manifest decency. Before Nixon's resignation, Ford had made a point of never asking him about Watergate afterward. Ford continued not to talk about it. He delivered his most famous line shortly after being sworn into office. "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over." The line resonated powerfully with the public, but Ford, being Ford, fretted that the line was too mean to Nixon. Tubin traces the steps of this convoluted dance. Nixon wanted a pardon and pretended he didn't. Ford wanted to grant the pardon and had a hard time hiding that fact. Through intermediaries, Nixon used his papers and tape recordings as leverage, maintaining that they belonged to him and not, as Ford insisted, to the government. Tubin calls Nixon's gambit a form of extortion. Until the Presidential Records Act of 1978, a president's papers were treated as his private property. Ford prevailed on the papers, but then felt, as Tubin puts it, he owed Nixon one. By pardoning Nixon, Ford also thought he could spare the country and move past the ugliness of Watergate. Tubin calls it a bad pardon for an honorable reason. It helped stoke the very cynicism it was supposed to quell. After years of legal squabbling, the papers and tapes were deemed Nixon's property after all, and in 2000, the federal government paid $18 million to buy them from his estate. Tubin admirably weaves all these threads together, but what struck me most about the pardon was how bizarrely quaint all the wrangling over Watergate seems now compared with the onslaught of our frenzied political moment. Take the notorious events of October 20, 1973, known as the Saturday Night Massacre, when Nixon ordered his attorney general to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor for the Watergate investigation. The attorney general refused and resigned. Then the deputy attorney general refused and resigned. In 1973, Nixon's abuse of power was outrageous, but the immediate victims of the Saturday Night Massacre could be counted on one hand. Contrast this with what has happened in the last 3 weeks. The Trump administration has been firing people at such a breakneck clip that a bewildered public can barely keep up. Within days of assuming office, Trump fired at least 17 inspectors general. A week later, reports trickled out about the firing of more than a dozen prosecutors who had worked on the January 6 cases. The same day, the public learned that Trump officials were setting the stage for possible purge at the FBI by ordering the Bureau to compile a list of all personnel who had worked on the January 6 cases. The number of names is likely to be about 6,000. Trump isn't known for his consistency, but he has shown a consistent fascination with making bids for unchecked presidential power. Revoking birthright citizenship, unilaterally shutting down federal agencies, firing federal workers willy-nilly, handing over key government functions to the billionaire Elon Musk, Trump has been daring the courts to stop him. His vice president, J.D. Vance, has aired the possibility of defying those courts if they try to. And on Monday, a judge ruled that the Trump administration had refused to comply with a court order to release billions of dollars in federal grants already allocated by Congress. Tubin's book offers little by way of consolation. Even in a democracy, the royal prerogative of mercy has its appeal, especially during cruel times. But as the pardon makes exceedingly clear, it can also serve as a weapon for a leader who insists he can do whatever he wants. The reviewer, Jennifer Zelay, is the nonfiction book critic for the New York Times. She writes essays and reviews about nonfiction books, often with an eye to how they connect to our current moment. Show, don't tell. Stories by Curtis Sittenfeld. The cover of this book shows an aerial view of calm ocean waters with a woman in a bathing suit floating on her back with her hands relaxed behind her neck. The reviewer is Jen Dahl. Curtis Sittenfeld's new stories revel in life's delicious mess. Her story collection is about the thorny conundrums of being alive. There is a picture of cardboard cutouts of a family, a father, a mother with a bird on her head, a daughter, standing in front of a clay model of a house with an attached garage and a lawn. The photo is by Stefan Debus. There seems to be a largely held belief, one easily argued against, and yet it persists, that at some point in our lives, perhaps around middle age, whenever that is, we'll have figured it all out. We will have accrued the proper things to make ourselves at least reasonably content, relationships, jobs, homes, children, all the stuff that makes a life. We will have done the due diligence of coming to terms with who we are, and we will forge ahead, no more questions asked, for all has been settled. Done and dusted, there's nothing to see here. Luckily, we have Curtis Sittenfeld to disabuse us of that rather stupid notion. Show Don't Tell, her ninth book and second story collection, proves that there's always something to see, or to be told if you prefer. In contradiction to the advice of its title, there's lots of telling in this book. Sittenfeld frequently opens with a character who seems to speak directly to the reader, often recapping a critical event that occurred in the past before bringing us back to the present to see how it all makes sense, or purposefully doesn't. In this way, reading Show Don't Tell is a bit like sitting down with a good friend who's about to dish on some major life business. The stories are messy, delicious, spun through with bits of quotable wisdom. If I'd still be me with Botox, why bother with the Botox? And complete with endings that will make you sit and think. Sittenfeld's headline-adjacent musings don't shy from addressing biases and assumptions of all stripes, nor does she fear a character who brings the cringe. And although you may see certain twists coming, most of them land with a satisfyingly unpredictable punch. In The Richest Babysitter in the World, Kit reflects upon her time spent caring for the child of a Jeff Bezos-like character before he became a famous billionaire. In White Women, LOL, Jill, a white woman, tries to redeem herself after she's canceled online for telling a group of black people who she believes are gatecrashers to leave a friend's birthday party. And in Lost But Not Forgotten, Sittenfeld brings back the character of Lee Fiora from her debut novel, Prep, now at her 30-year school reunion, reflecting on her past while grappling with her future and a potential new love. Show Don't Tell is a supposedly golden rule in creative writing, another largely held belief that comes down to quite a few assumptions about how things should be. In using the edict as her collection's title, but then willfully disobeying it and making it all so much darn fun, Sittenfeld is saying a lot about the constraints we, and particularly middle-aged women, have come to accept. Showcasing the glory over characters' complicated lives and allowing them to speak with voices all their own is a kind of rebellion, and it's exhilarating. In the title story, we meet Ruthie Flaherty, a 25-year-old nearing the end of her first year of a graduate writing program, waiting for the letter that will notify her of her second year of funding, which will define her next steps as a person in the world. The many distractions she faces swirl through the story. Among them, she wants to win back the affections of her classmate, Doug, get her 50-year-old grad student neighbor to stop smoking in her apartment, and figure out how to respond to Badveer, a male classmate who insists beautiful women can't write great literature. Of course, what Ruthie is really trying to figure out is who she will be. And by the completion of the story, has she succeeded? 20 years later, she's a best-selling author. As it happens, my novels are considered women's fiction, she explains, and meeting Badveer, who has attained the status we all believed ourselves to be aspiring to back then, for a drink. Once there, Badveer insists on naming the classmates who aren't writers, and it's not until months later that Ruthie figures out how she wishes she'd responded. Yes, you can say whether people have published books, she thinks, but you don't get to say whether they're writers. The way they inhabit the world, the way they observe it, of course they're writers. You may wonder, particularly after this story, how much of Sittenfeld's own life is in the book. But don't be distracted. Show Don't Tell raises bigger and more important questions, like, what if life was never about figuring it all out, but instead about simply living it the best way we can? As Lee Fiora says, if I'm right that all this is ordinary, I'm enormously grateful for it. Our ordinary life, our closeness, is thrilling to me. The reviewer, Jen Dahl, is the author of a memoir and two young adult novels. You didn't hear this from me. Mostly True Notes on Gossip, mostly is in parentheses, by Kelsey McKinney. The book cover has an orange background and has drawn pictures of pairs of eyes looking in different directions. The reviewer is Marissa Meltzer. You know you love gossip. Does it love you back? The writer, Kelsey McKinney, tries to wrestle with our guiltiest pleasure. There is a black and white photo of a woman in a buttoned-up dress, François Gillot, and Pablo Picasso at her side, holding her arm and looking at the camera sideways. The caption reads as follows. François Gillot and Pablo Picasso, writes Kelsey McKinney, were two subjects of contemporary gossip. For those who love it, live for it, and regularly traffic in it, nothing is more delicious than exchanging gossip. Kelsey McKinney is one of us. In You Didn't Hear This From Me, mostly True Notes on Gossip, she writes, what I crave is a phone call that starts with, you're never going to believe this. McKinney is a creator of the podcast Normal Gossip, which provides all the kicks of rumor mongering and none of the baggage. Each week, she recounts to a guest an anonymized story from someone else's life, drama at a dog park, say, or an episode of cheating at bingo. At its most basic, gossip is just one person talking to another about someone who isn't present. McKinney writes in a fair example of the book's dialectic style. In You Didn't Hear This From Me, she seeks to understand why we do it and why it's important. I just wish the result were more fun. This book, a collection of essays, contains some amusing historical accounts, such as how women in 16th century Scotland were put into the brank to curb women's tongues that talk too idle, as one such iron bridle was inscribed. There is a passage about town topics, a kind of Us Weekly of the Gilded Age, which published juicy, blind items about Alice Roosevelt having allegedly listened to risque jokes in Newport. More so than its lineage, McKinney aims to understand gossip's place in our lives. The book is laden with references to very recent history, topics that were obviously the talk of the tout internet at the time of writing, but already feel dated. The show Hannah Gadsby created at Brooklyn Museum, mentioned in a chapter about tell-alls. West Elm Caleb, who wooed many women via online dating platforms, referenced in a discussion of strangers online. And the social media account Dumois, which self-presented as arbiters of celebrity gossip. By the time McKinney mentions America Ferrera's speech about the expectations placed on women in the Barbie movie, I had lost track of what the point was. Doja Cat's song, Need to Know, the finale of a Real Housewives of Salt Lake City season, the reality game show Traitors, and Britney Spears' conservatorship are just a few of the topics in which the reader must be already interested, because the book doesn't manage to elevate them much. Much juicier are the anonymous anecdotes and vignettes slipped between chapters, which serve to illustrate how gossip is used in real life, including the scene in which members of a wedding party dish about the complicated love life of an arriving guest and the description of a high school that publicly posts students' disciplinary infractions. These interludes are brief, but shine far more brightly than the book's essays. The writing of these essays relies heavily on quotes from an array of other thinkers. In just a few pages, one encounters the philosopher Aaron Ben-Ziev on whether we are born with a desire to gossip, the anthropologist Robin Dunbar on gossip's relation to the animal kingdom, and Eric Howell, a neuroscientist, discussing its development in humanity. Soren Kierkegaard, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Emily Dickinson, Bell Hooks, Oscar Wilde, and Kurt Vonnegut all weigh the book down further. I'd rather know what the author thinks. She occasionally dips into her own formative experiences, such as the time a storyteller came to her school to tell a spooky yarn from their small town that was really an urban legend, or the experience of growing up in an evangelical church culture where gossip was considered an affront to God. McKinney seems to still be wrestling with her own relationship to gossip, whether it can be fun or is something to condemn. The sense of awe I felt when a car careens around a turn and the land lies out in front of me and it feels divine is almost identical to the physical experience of the gasp that involuntarily escapes my mouth when someone sends me a 12-minute voice memo filled with good information. She likes when gossip builds community or spreads warnings against predators. She approves of gossip that holds people accountable and keeps power in check. But she gets a little pious when it comes to parasocial relationships. About Taylor Swift and her love life, McKinney writes that the singer does not owe fans personal details. The essays don't dig deep enough into her ambivalence about gossip to come away with any big ideas. Instead, she writes, "In a few years, I will have no memory of writing most of this. It will fade from me, even as it stays in print." No one should aspire to write a book as ephemeral as a rumor. The reviewer, Marissa Meltzer, is the author of Glossy, Ambition, Beauty, and the Inside Story of Emily Weiss's Glossier. Two books chock full of worthwhile ideas, A Study of Human Fatigue and A Cranky Travel Memoir. The reviewer, there is a picture of an impressionistic style painting in pale blues and yellows of a woman reclining on a couch, leaning on her elbow, reading a book. Dear readers, if the retail price of a book were pegged to the number of high-quality ideas it contained, the two books below would sell for downright goofy sums. And by the same logic, a book that contained zero ideas, or worse, lazy or unsupported ones, would owe the reader money for squandered time. This is my platform. Vote Molly for president. The Human Motor: Energy, Fatigue, and the Origins of Modernity, by Anson Rabenbach. The book cover shows a shiny silver statue of a sideways standing human between two large spoked wheels. Why did Red Bull sell 12.7 billion cans of energy drink last year? Why is it a common and accepted practice to track one's daily steps? Why did a German chemist named Wilhelm Weikhard attempt to invent a vaccine for fatigue in the early 20th century, and crucially, if he was successful, where can we present our upper arms for immediate injection? These questions are answered in The Human Motor, if only implicitly as regards the first two. Rabenbach, who died recently at age of 79, has loftier concerns than the state of Red Bull's market share. He begins his dazzling study with the observation that certain 19th century scientific discoveries about energy transformed conceptions of labor. The first two laws of thermodynamics, Rabenbach argues, exerted a magnetic metaphoric force, leading workers to be seen as machines for converting energy into output. The difference between machines and bodies, of course, is that our squishy meat envelopes aren't designed for nonstop labor. This idea of body as flawed machine led to a new obsession with fatigue, which emerged as the big enemy of productivity. The previous big enemy had been idleness. Today's big enemy, surely, is distraction. These words are capitalized to indicate that we are, as they say, in the presence of constructs. A review of the book in this newspaper complained that Mr. Rabenbach is no great stylist. I disagree. His stylistic flourishes are on the level of connecting distant dots and unearthing rare gems of sources, though I have no complaints regarding his adjectives either. About that fatigue vaccine, Weikert did not, in the end, succeed in concocting one, though his research proceeded impressively to the point where a classroom of unsuspecting German children was sprayed with a substance isolated during rat trials. The symptoms of fatigue may be masked temporarily, Red Bull helps, but, alas, they cannot be reversed. On Trying to Keep Still by Jenny Diskey. I recommend Diskey to all my favorite cranky people as a gesture of affection and respect, because she offers the finest proof that crankiness and lovability may not be merely coexist, but thrive in concert. This is an important reminder, given our era's relentless devaluation of crankiness as a human condition. Someday, I'll write an essay about that, unless one of you beats me to it. Crankiness is not a symptom for rudeness. It's a state of reaction that, I'd hazard, results from three things. Number one, maintaining inflexibly high standards. Number two, being indefatigably expressive about them. And number three, lacking the compulsion to pander. For Diskey, who died in 2016, crankiness was a source of comedy and self-insight, two qualities that are densely present in this account of roaming from New Zealand to Lapland to the English countryside. When Diskey traveled, she did not seek adventure or stimulating encounters with foreign stews, but places in which to sit still and be left alone, to occupy her comfort zone as a mistress of stasis. The reviewer, Molly Young, is a book critic for the New York Times, a contributing writer for the Times Magazine, and the creator of the newsletter Read Like the Wind, a weekly list of book recommendations. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.